Last year, India overtook China as the world's most populous country with 1.4 billion people, and it's tipped to move from the fifth to the third largest economy in the next 5 years. In contrast to the slow global growth predicted in 2024, India's government expects its economy to grow by around 7% this year. The growth is being driven domestically by the country's burgeoning and youthful population, massive infrastructure programs, significant investments in clean energy, and a growing stock market. I'm Jeremy Maggs. This is No Ordinary Wednesday. It's an in-depth look at what's driving markets, shaping the economy, and changing the game. In this episode, we'll talk to two Investec leaders who joined a delegation of 20 staff on a fact-finding mission to India. And together, we're going to take a look at India's growth story, its trajectory, its future prospects, and explore opportunities for investors. Ali Nautier, Joint Head of National Wealth Management for Investec Wealth and Investment, along with Neo Matlangu, Regional Head of Investec Private Bank, a warm welcome to No Ordinary Wednesday. So Ali, let's start this with setting the scene for our listeners, if we can. The success is not only intriguing, but the numbers also tell us that it's impressive as well. What do you think is driving India's rapid growth?
So obviously the growth at the moment is that we've had 6% growth there. I think that the growth at the moment has been driven by the lack of appetite or the diminishing appetite for China's exports. I think that that's probably one of the biggest reasons. And then you've got a population of 1.5 billion. Of the population now, 1.2 billion have got SIM cards. 1.2 billion have actually got a card, an ID card, which is centralized in terms of the control, which is called an IDA number. And in order to get grants post and during COVID, people had to get an IDA number and a bank account. And I think that that has really increased digitization of the entire economy. So although we've got the export potential, we've also got a growing digitized population, which are now starting to travel and do all sorts of things online, which they weren't doing before. Interestingly enough, we were up in the mountains at one part. At the end of the trip, we did a side trip up into the mountains and we were watching cricket at about 3,600 meters just on Wi-Fi.
So, Neo, let me bring you into the conversation and just leading on from what Ali says and watching cricket in the mountains. I've been to India a couple of times myself, and what always impresses me is the commitment to success and the frenetic energy, particularly in the bigger cities. What Ali's outlined for us all seems like an ingredient for success. Obviously, the big question, though, that investors want to know is, do you think it's sustainable?
I wish I had a crystal ball that could tell me, but I think the fact is there are some fundamental things that make us believe that, at least in the short term, it is. The fact that they've been able to keep a 5-7% growth rate and one that we foresee in the future is highly linked to their ability to attract foreign investment. And I think that's been in part due to a few factors. I think Ali's mentioned a little bit around, you know, you've got a large population, which in turn has a large labor force. And I think they've managed to keep that labor force quite competitive in terms of how it's priced for the skill that you get. They've also set to become the world's third largest economy, at least consumer market, by 2027. So that's, I think, something that most people would be looking to get close to. And then also there is the fact that they're starting from quite a low base. If you look at India at the moment, they only make up 2.9% of global manufacturing output. And China next door is at about 31%. So there's a hell of a lot of potential. And as long as they're easing the ability to do the foreign direct investment, I think there is some sustainability in these numbers.
Now, notwithstanding those observations, what do you think makes the Indian economy so resilient, particularly given the global volatility that we are experiencing right now?
Yeah, so I do think, you know, they're not completely immune to that volatility, but there are a number of factors that allow them to smooth the trends out. I think the production-linked incentive schemes that the government put in place has helped in that regard. There's also quite a lot of support to diversify manufacturing in that part of the world, with some countries looking to diversify risk away from having sort of one large player like a China. You couple that with some strong reserves of essential mines for minerals like iron ore, and you've got some ingredients there for what is essentially a new economy in the marketing space. They're also quite well positioned as a leading country in some popular industries like tech, like pharma, which also assist them to reduce that volatility. And then I think one unusual thing that I picked up is that they've got an attitude towards gearing, which is a little bit different to a lot of the emerging markets. If you look at the corporate sector, for example, China's corporate credit to GDP ratio sits at about 160%, while in India, the same figure is around 55%. Some of these ingredients, I think, are why their volatility is reduced compared to other emerging markets.
Ali, the demographics are absolutely fascinating. If I'm not mistaken, more than 50% of the country's population is below the age of 25. It's a very youthful economy. Going forward, this is surely going to contribute positively to the country's future prospects.
You could see it as positive, but it's not. It is actually, in our minds, a potential impediment as well, because they're going to continue to require strong GDP growth every year in order to actually provide enough jobs for those coming into the job market. And much of the growth thus far has occurred in much less labor-intensive services. So, you know, jobless growth is actually bad for the country. You know, we need to ramp up industrialization a lot more in order to create more jobs.
Now, let me come back to you. Figures out from the United Nations suggest that global economic uncertainty, we've just referenced the volatility, dropping or resulting in a drop, should I say, of around 9% in foreign direct investment flows into developing countries in 2023. India, obviously not immune to this, a 47% drop in FDI inflows. But surely with the positive growth story that you've both outlined, India has got to be on the radar of international investors. So, where do those opportunities exist?
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. Even in a world where there's quite a lot of volatility, there are things that India seems to continue to do a little bit better than other emerging markets. If you look at the services piece, which Ali spoke to, it's always been underscored as a massive advantage for India. And so I think you're still going to find a hell of a lot of opportunity in the IT and software industries, especially given how good India is at the tertiary level in those particular fields. There are a few other places as you start to try and diversify that economy and bring more labor-intensive sort of work into the country. And so we think that there would be some opportunities in the construction industry, oil and gas, which they currently as a country still import quite a large amount of, coal. I've mentioned a little bit about IT, but electronics themselves, the hardware is starting to become an industry, data centers, semiconductors, and then also some opportunity in the wealth and investment and banking space. The unique thing that India has, being a largely new or emerging economy in that it's a small percentage of the population that's in the formal market, is that there's large scale for organic in-country growth. One of the companies that we met in the FMCG market, we asked them what your plans are for expansion. And they were like, no, we're just trying to figure out how we're going to succeed in the state next door. It's a very different way of thinking to South Africa, where our entire population is 55 million. And sometimes that's a single state in India.
Absolutely astonishing. Ali, let's try and temper some of Neo's enthusiasm if we can. What are some of the challenges then, or difficulties both in the country and globally, that in your opinion could impede India's growth aspirations and investments? It's not all going to be smooth sailing, is it?
No, I mean, I think there are a few factors that definitely are cause for concern. You know, India, as opposed to China, runs a deficit. And therefore, it is exposed to volatility and it relies, I think, about 80% on coal and petroleum. So that would definitely be a risk to the rupee and the economy. And I think that there's a lot of bullishness in thinking that because they're going to now export so much more, they would pick up the flak effectively from China, that you should see a rupee actually appreciating. But I think that there's quite a big question around whether it's really going to take up all the slack from China. And the view of a lot of us on the trip was that China's just not going to lie down and let India take over as the export country of choice for the globe. There are also looming social problems and a bit of instability. You know, the cities are racked with pollution. The cities are construction sites. You know, this jobless growth that we've spoken about is a problem. The education system still needs to be reformed. There's a bit of lingering corruption. There's a fair amount of unfinished government reform in terms of its programs. Even Modi's done quite a good job. But, you know, Indians love change and national elections are coming up in 2024. We've got a government there that's prickly about criticism. They're hampering a bit of oversight of the corporate center. You know, I think that that could be worrying for Modi if he wants to get reelected. Manufacturing sector, it's growing quickly, but obviously can the infrastructure keep up? And I think the worrying thing is that has the cheap trade gone? I mean, the market has really grown a lot in the last couple of years. And lastly, you know, the concentration of economic power, 20 of the companies in 20 companies basically generate 80% of India's GDP. And 40% of the average free float is also owned by retail ownership, not institutional, who are much more kind of volatile investors than, say, long-term institutional investors. So there are definitely some concerns over the general picture.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment, but first I'd like to tell you about The Current. It's a new series that has launched on Investec Focus Radio SA. Hosted by seasoned broadcaster Iman Rapetti, the show delves into key aspects of South Africa's energy transition, from fixing Eskom to exploring the potential of electric vehicles and the role the mining, oil and gas sectors have to play. Episode 1 has just dropped. To listen, follow Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. Ali, back to you. And India has been dependent on its agricultural and service sectors for a long time. That was raised a little earlier by both you and Neo. But again, having done this quite thoroughly, one imagines, what other sectors then excited you on this trip? And how do you see the makeup of India's economy evolving beyond farming, call center and IT support?
Yeah, I think there's great potential for industries such as, you know, Western data centers, green tech and renewables, hotel and travel. I mean, a lot of the locals now, especially with SIM cards, are now able to go online and look at, even within domestic travel, funny enough, is where they're starting to travel where they didn't do before. They can get online and look at areas in India that they haven't even considered. Obviously, construction is a potential, mobile gaming, and we were very excited about, you know, the wealth management space as well. I'll give two examples of two companies that we met in different industries. But for example, an online travel company, very similar to Booking.com, and they were getting a lot of the Indian hotels, airlines all on board. They had very innovative thinking around providing corporates with in-house travel services. And then we met a company, which was a wealth management company, that had really grown to $40 billion of assets in a very short space of time. I think they started in 2008. And obviously, India has got a very, very growing, affluent, high net worth market that are slowly starting to move away from, you know, buying just stocks on their own. And they love gold. But we think that the potential to show people the benefits of proper global wealth management is a great potential as well. Effectively, some of the regulation around in the market hopefully will start to drop off, very similar to how South Africa did. Currently, you can only take $250,000 out of the country a year. But if that regulation starts to come down and you can externalize more, I think there's great potential to create global wealth management for affluent Indians.
And Ali, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the stock market has had a stellar year. I think it's even overtaken Hong Kong's market value. That would make it the world's fourth largest equity market. Do you see this momentum continuing?
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, as long as GDP growth rolls along at a premium to other emerging markets, then yes. I mean, the companies that we met, we found many of the companies to be very high quality businesses. There's plenty of growth runway, especially if you consider that the top companies take up 80% of GDP. There's a lot of room for growth. Obviously, we're a little bit worried about the upcoming elections, as I mentioned earlier. But really, if you actually look at the underlying numbers, just to summarize, you know, the 10-year India numbers in terms of growth are 11.84% versus emerging markets at 4.69%. And even though India's PE is at a 23 versus emerging markets at a 13 and a price to book at 3.5 versus 1.54, we really do think that if the growth comes through with the demographic change, increasing digitization and the ease to do business, which has been a fundamental difference that we've seen in the last, call it 5 to 10 years, we think that the growth could continue and it's a very exciting area.
Nao, back to you then. The key considerations that investors should be considering if they're looking to enter or expand their investments in this very exciting market.
I think it's definitely an interesting emerging market complex in India, just given some of the issues that we've spoken to around China, and then I guess linked to the structural positives in India. I think the Indian market has outperformed other major equity markets for good reason. They've had better earnings growth, and headline valuations look expensive, but when you adjust for earnings growth, then all of a sudden they look like they're in line or reasonable. And there's also just been a piece around higher quality earnings history, which justifies some of this valuation. I think their stock market also has quite a bit of diversification in it. And regulation looks, at least at the outset, quite strong and enabling. I think where the risks sort of sit is the retail ownership, the large retail ownership in that market. I've seen quite a lot of leveraged positions in that space because of that. What would that mean? Liquidity, I guess, is linked to that risk around the makeup of who owns a lot of the stock. And then some of the same risks that the rest of us in emerging markets sort of sit with. There's electoral risk. I think every other country in the world is having an election this year, and so too in India. What happens to some of those reforms should there be a change in government? The demographic peace is also something to consider. You know, you've got a large young population in India. If they do come on stream into that economy, a hell of a lot of growth all of a sudden exists. But if that doesn't quite happen, you could see increased levels of poverty. And then I guess if you consider where India is in the world, physically, there are some geopolitical issues that you would need to consider, not any different to the rest of the world. But I guess at the end of it, if you really think about all of these things, there is a fundamental piece that you've got to have right, and that is to find the right valuations. It's quite difficult with numbers that are that big to understand what is a true valuation, what is only potential, what is true realization. And I think that still remains a cornerstone of any investment risk process is the valuations.
Just as a result of that, and in light of the risks now that you've outlined, India is undoubtedly the darling of the emerging markets right now. Are there lessons that other emerging markets like us, for instance, can learn from that country?
There definitely are. As a big piece for what we experience, the level of competency in the civil service is something that you actually cannot discount. It's allowed them to have a set of governing principles and the creation of legislation that's all geared towards trying to achieve the same thing. And there's been quite a lot of execution in what that looks like. So that ease of making business piece we spoke around, some of the reforms that are built into legislation, the government constantly looking at which industries should we be participating in, a public and private participation. And so that ease of doing business has been a big part of what they've done right and something we could look to get towards. I think Ali did mention, you know, the digitization of the population and the Aadhaar system has allowed government to really increase their transmission of funds. And so the ability to get cash into people's hands, the ability to understand any particular pieces of information or to manage somebody in a public health system could change with an Aadhaar system. And we've got similar systems in the context of South Africa that are being built, at least in the banking sector. You could look to how you could use or expand PayShap. I think for a long time now, Home Affairs has had some digital applications. And so there's a lot of parallels there in how you could continue to work. And then I guess on the other side, a lesson I didn't think I would learn is there's a lot of hype around India now. But people mustn't forget, I guess, how long it took to build some of the resilience and discipline in order to do some of these things. If I look at South Africa and some of the risks that we face with potential coalitions, etc. I think it took India three times trying a coalition before it really stuck. And so hopefully we don't have to learn the same lesson should we go down that route. And where we've already got those coalitions in some of the municipalities, I think there's some lessons to be learned there. So yeah, very exciting place to be, but it hasn't always been easy even for the Indian economy. And I think they are still quite at an infancy of what their growth could look like.
All right, now I'm going to take that as your final comments. Ali, back to you very quickly. What was your big impression of this trip and what was your key takeaway?
Just the impression for me particularly was the digitization. I mean, I was there and I spent a lot of time there in 2005. There weren't really cell phones in those days there. And to see everyone now on their phones in the most remotest of areas, it was exceptionally exciting. And I think Modi, has really done a good job. And you can see the excitement on the ground and in the markets. Obviously, we have to tread exceptionally carefully, but I think some good business ideas will do exceptionally well.
Ali Nautia, Neo Matlangu, thank you both for joining me for a fascinating conversation on this episode of No Ordinary Wednesday. A new episode of No Ordinary Wednesday drops every fortnight. To ensure you don't miss a show, follow Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the channel, please take a moment to rate us. Until next time, goodbye from me, Jeremy Maggs, and the entire Focus Radio team.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendations. Investec Limited and subsidiaries, authorized financial service providers, registered credit providers, and long-term insurer.